In chapters 26 through 28, we clearly move into the most momentous events of the Gospels, the betrayal and death of Jesus and his resurrection. Chapter 26 is a lengthy chapter which has to do with what happened immediately before Jesus was handed over to the Roman procurator Pontius Pilate. Verse 1. Now it came to pass, when Jesus had finished all these sayings, that he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." So here is Jesus again, this time very close to the actual event, and forewarning his disciples of his coming demise. Now, crucifixion, as we have said, was held to be the most contemptible death possible for anyone, and was not something that was mentioned in polite society. So for Jesus to die in such a way would have been unthinkable for the disciples. But Jesus has to be held between heaven and earth as a curse for mankind, as Paul says in quoting the Old Testament in Galatians 3:13. And so the narrative starts to move quickly here. We leave Jesus and we start to hone in on the chief priests. Then the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. Now, Joseph Caiaphas is well known from history. Josephus mentions him as the longest-serving high priest of the first century. He was high priest for 18 years, and mainly held that office for so long because the Romans saw it as expedient to keep him in office, since he was very concerned with keeping the peace and the status quo. It is possible that Caiaphas's ossuary, the box that his bones would have been put in, has been discovered, although there is some dispute about that. But there's no dispute about the existence of this person. And we know that he was the kind of person that is described by the Gospels. Now, they didn't want to take Jesus during the feast because they didn't want to cause an uproar among the people. Verse 5. There had been such uproars before, and this had often resulted in people being trampled to death and in Roman security, which was tight anyway, being increased, and therefore the whole feast being, in a sense, overshadowed by the increased security and presence of the Roman soldiers. Notice the correspondence between verse 2 and verse 5. Jesus says, "In 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." Verse 2 says, "Not during the feast," the actual feast itself, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, "lest there be an uproar among the people." So Jesus here is reading the minds of those that are plotting to kill him. Now, actually, they will put him to death during the time of the feast. So their plans will change as they perhaps see their hand forced by events, or as they see opportunity with Judas' betrayal of Jesus. This is the only place where Matthew refers the death of Christ to the Passover itself, in verse 2. And of course, Paul does this also in 1 Corinthians 5:7, verse 6. "And when Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper," this is somebody that we don't know about, but he was obviously a follower of Jesus. He had the nickname leper. He was probably somebody who Jesus had healed. "A woman came to him having an alabaster flask of very costly fragrant oil, and she poured it on his head as he sat at the table." Now, this oil, we know from elsewhere, was very expensive. It was worth a year's wage for the common laborer. And they would keep these in alabaster jars so that when the jar was broken, the substance had to be used straight away. We know this woman is Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus. See John 12:3. Although she's not named by Matthew or Mark in his account of this. And that's interesting because of what's said in verse 13 about wherever the gospel is preached, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her. Well, if she's not named, then it's only the act of a woman that is remembered. But John, who writes, of course, many years later than Matthew, does name her. And so there's an interesting link between Jesus' prediction in verse 13 and the naming of the woman by the Apostle John in approximately AD 90. It was customary to anoint an important person, especially before a meal, and the ointment would be poured on the person's head. This woman, we know from elsewhere, also used her hair to wipe Jesus' feet, which would have been dirty. And so she is paying him a very high honor here in doing this. Now Jesus says in verse 12 that she did it for my burial. This is probably not what her intention was when she did this, but this is what, in the providence of God, she was actually doing. And so God is bringing about here an anointing of Jesus and a special honoring of him before his burial, but using the actions of somebody who didn't intend it that way, just intended it as an honor for her Lord. But the disciples, of course, complained, as they often did, why this waste? It could have been sold and given to the poor. Jesus' response is, why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a good work for me. Again, this focuses on his person, on his importance, on his lordship. Matthew wants us to see the importance of Jesus' identity and us acknowledging that identity. And so it was certainly not wrong for her to do this. She realized who Jesus was and she wanted to pay him a special privilege. What better way to use this expensive nard, which is what it was, we're told in Mark, than to anoint the Messiah? And so she was showing more faith and more comprehension than the disciples. But then after this, we hear that Judas goes out to betray Jesus. Judas was probably the chief one who complained about what the woman did. And so the contrast between what the woman did in using a very expensive ointment to anoint Jesus' head and what Judas did in betraying Jesus for a fairly paltry amount, 30 pieces of silver, really comes to the surface here. 30 pieces of silver, according to Exodus 21:32, was compensation for the price of a slave if he died from unnatural causes at somebody else's hand. And so this is a cheap estimation that Judas has of his master. Verse 17. Now on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying to him, where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover? Of course, Jerusalem would have been tremendously crammed at this time with all of the pilgrims, and Bethany likewise. And so this is a good question. Jesus said, verse 18, go into the city to a certain man and say to him, the teacher says, my time is at hand, I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples. So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. Now, if the disciples had just taken it upon themselves to find a place to eat the Passover, then it is very likely that they would have come up empty-handed. All the rooms were being let at this time. But nothing is left to chance. God has already sorted out providentially exactly where the Passover is going to be held. So even though it might have felt to the disciples that they didn't know where they would get a room in order to celebrate the Passover together, this was already in hand. Jesus knew exactly where to go. To prepare the Passover was to get ready for the eating. So to prepare the chairs or the couches, to prepare the spices and the different foods, the bitter herbs, for example, and everything that was necessary, everything that they could do, sweeping the room, making sure there was no leaven there. All of these things were involved in preparing the Passover, as well as taking the Passover lamb to the priests for the priests to slay it. It would then be returned to them and they would eat it on the Friday evening. When evening had come, he sat down with the 12. So Judas is still there. Now, as they were eating, he said, "Assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were exceedingly sorrowful. And each of them began to say to him, "Lord, is it I?" He answered and said, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me." Now, this would have been an awful thing to consider. Even in the West, when we invite somebody to dinner, we do so to extend a hand of friendship to them. We don't expect to be stabbed in the back. But this was even more so in the ancient Near East, where it would have been almost unthinkable for somebody to have betrayed somebody in this way. The Son of Man, verse 24, indeed goes just as it is written of him, bringing in the correspondence of his death with the scriptures. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born. In other words, in comparison to what is going to happen to him under the judgment of God, it would have been better if he had never existed. This, by the way, was quite a common phrase, it seems, in ancient Israel. Then Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, "Rabbi, is it I?" And he said to him, "You have said it." In other words, the condemnation has come out of Judas' own mouth. And now we come to this interesting passage, an important passage, that we have to take seriously as Christians. Not just because it is the institution of the Lord's Supper, that's obvious, but because of its relation to the new covenant, which many Christians, particularly dispensationalists, really don't take account of as well as they ought to. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you." Now, it is often held and taught, especially by Messianic Jews, that the rabbinic traditions surrounding the taking of the Passover mirror exactly Jesus' practice at the Last Supper. But it needs to be noted that although this is likely, it is not provable, because the sources which are used to prove this were written hundreds of years after the time of Jesus. And so, even though probably little changed, if anything, between, say, AD 30 and AD 250 and following and afterwards, it should not be pressed dogmatically that what we have in the Mishnah and in the Talmud later is exactly what Jesus did. However, it is likely. We know, for example, from 1 Corinthians 11:23 that Jesus took the Passover at night. We know that Jesus took bread and prayed over it, gave thanks and broke it. That was customary, it seemed, at Jewish meals. The elements were interpreted in a symbolic way, which is what Jesus did. That interpretation among the Jews was that the bread was interpreted as the Exodus and interpreted as deliverance from Egypt. See Exodus 24:8. Also, the Hallel group of psalms from Psalm 113 to Psalm 118 were sang after the meal in Jewish households. I have this material, by the way, from Craig Keener and his book, The Historical Jesus of the Gospels, page 298. Now, of course, Jesus gave some added interpretations, or some new interpretations, didn't he? He interpreted the bread as his body, not as the Exodus. He interpreted the cup as his blood of the new covenant, not the blood that was daubed on the lintel and the doorposts at the Exodus. Although we should keep in mind that the blood that was daubed, one on the lintel, two on the doorpost, would have made a cross shape. And of course, the new covenant was known from the Old Testament, particularly Jeremiah 31:31, But Jesus here is inaugurating it. So let's have a look at these verses a little closer here in view of this. Verse 26, Jesus is taking the bread, blessing it and breaking it, and he's identifying it with his own body, which he has already told the disciples is going to be crucified on a Roman cross. And so if they'd have had presence of mind, they would have realized the extreme solemnity of what was going on here, that the bread that they were eating was taking on a completely new significance, the greatest significance, the significance of the Messiah's own body being broken for them. And the same thing with the blood. This was no longer the blood of the Lamb, which typified the final redemption of the promised seed, all the way back to Genesis 3:15. This was the blood of the Lamb of God, and they were to share in that too. Drink it, all of you. But he identifies this blood as the blood of the new covenant. And so we oughtn't to separate the new covenant from the cross. If we do this, I think that we are both committing an exegetical error in the Gospels, not to mention 1 Corinthians 11, but we're also committing quite a strong theological error. And we're doing it because we are refusing to observe progressive revelation. We're sticking back in the Old Testament with Jeremiah 31, and we're saying because Jeremiah 31 says Israel and Judah, that the new covenant is limited to Israel and Judah. But of course, the new covenant is going to be limited to Israel and Judah in the context of the prophetic pronouncements of Jeremiah 30 through 33, which deal with the eschaton, the last days, and of course the renewal of Israel. But this does not mean that that's all there is to say about the new covenant. And of course, Paul in Galatians 3 makes this clear. He quotes, for example, Genesis 12:3, "In you will all the families of the earth be blessed," as a new covenant passage, and relates it to the church. And not only does he do that, but he is very clear in 1 Corinthians 11, verses 23 through 34, that the Lord's Supper is a commemoration of the new covenant that has been inaugurated and will be consummated at the return of Christ. And so I don't think there's any escaping the sense of the clear wording of these texts. When Christ's blood was shed, the new covenant was inaugurated, because that's the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. Well, are your sins remitted? Are my sins remitted? They are remitted on the basis of the new covenant. That is what Jesus said in verse 28. And so for those dispensationalists, and there are too many of them, who say that the new covenant is just for Israel and not for the church, I think that they are actually leaving behind their dispensational hermeneutics and not paying due attention to what Jesus himself says in the Gospels. There is no need to think that the blood of the new covenant is solely for Israel. Why would it be? It's clearly for us too. It's for all sinners. Does this mean that God makes two new covenants, as Louis Berrichafer thought, one with the church and one later with Israel? No, it doesn't mean that at all. There's no need to make two new covenants, since everybody is saved under the auspices of one covenant that's been made at Calvary. That doesn't mean that future Israel is in the church either. It just means that everybody is saved on the basis of the blood of Christ, and of course his resurrection. Verse 29, "But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on till that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." Well, who are these people who he is inaugurating the Lord's Supper with, and who is drinking the wine with, which is the wine of the new covenant? It is the disciples who, according to Ephesians 2:20, will become the foundations of the church. So you can't get away from it, you see. The new covenant is most definitely made with the church and will be made, the same new covenant, with Israel in the millennium at return of Christ. Another thing also, this is wine. It's fermented wine. It is not grape juice. And there is no good evidence that it was grape juice. I don't care what certain American studies have shown. The scholarly studies are quite clear. This was not grape juice. It was fermented wine. There's nothing wrong with drinking fermented wine. Just don't drink too much of it. Remember the book of Proverbs. And of course, if you want to abstain, as I do, I think that that is a wise course. But it's not a law. It's not a requirement of the Bible. Okay, moving on. Verse 30. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." And then he says something that is very important for the disciples to remember. Verse 32, "But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Now, it seems that they forget about this after the crucifixion, and they have to be reminded by the angels and by Jesus himself when he meets them. Peter answered and said to him, "Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble." Now again, this is Peter getting ahead of himself. If the scripture says that the flock will be scattered, then Peter saying, "I will not be one of those who are scattered," is putting himself against the scriptures. And so Jesus said, "Assuredly, I say to you that this night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Not just once, but three times, Peter. You don't know yourself. Peter said to him, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." So said all his disciples. Well, if you read on, this becomes quite clear that Peter was speaking from emotion, but not from self-knowledge. Then Jesus came with them to the place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, "Sit here while I go and pray over there." Now they had to stay at Gethsemane, which was on the Mount of Olives, and not go back to Bethany because they had to be within the precincts of Jerusalem to spend Passover night. That was the tradition, and so they were following that tradition. Gethsemane, by the way, means oil press. And so there was probably an oil press and an olive grove at this place. Not surprising, as it was on the base of the Mount of Olives. Now Jesus has come to Gethsemane, and he's going to prepare himself now for what he's going to endure at the trial and at the cross. This agony in the garden, as it's so memorably referred to, is where Jesus actually won the victory. This is where Jesus struggles. This is where Jesus has to overcome. This is where the battle is fought, as far as Jesus is concerned. This is where Satan is defeated, as far as the battle of wills is concerned, right here in Gethsemane. "And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed." It appears that he's not allowed himself to show distress up to this time, but now the emotion pours out. "He said to them, 'My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me.'" Jesus is bowed down with the burden of what lies ahead of him, and he just wants their companionship as he prays. "He went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will.'" The cup was signified the cup of the wrath of God, as it is spoken of in the Old Testament. It's what he has to drink from in order for us to be saved. But he doesn't want to do it, not in his physical form. He doesn't want to endure the humiliation. He doesn't want to endure the shame and the agony, and more than this, he doesn't want to endure the break in fellowship between himself and his Father, that indescribable loving bond between the persons of the Trinity is going to be disrupted at the cross because of our sins. And so if there is any other way, of course Jesus knows that it's not, but in his trouble and in his distress he prays this way, then let the cup pass from me. Nevertheless, he is content to do the Father's will, not as I will, in my fear and in my anxiety, but as you will. In other words, he's going to follow through on what has to be done because it's God's will, it's the Father's will, even if he doesn't want to do it. Jesus was tremendously courageous and brave, facing his fears in prayer to his Father. Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "What? Could you not watch with me 1 hour?" Whether it was an actual hour or just a period of time is inconsequential here. "Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Their spirit was willing, their flesh was weak. And this is the same with Jesus. His spirit was willing to do what the Father wanted, but his flesh was weak. Yet he did not allow the flesh to take control and to command him, as it had with the disciples. He carried on praying in his agony. Again, a second time, he went away and prayed, saying, "O my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done." And he came and found them asleep, for their eyes were heavy. This would have been around about 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and so it would have been a long day, and they would be very tired. So he left them, went away again, and prayed the third time, saying the same words. Then he came to his disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude, with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now, the chief priests wouldn't come themselves, but they sent a large guard to come and arrest Jesus. His words in verse 46 would have contained some alacrity for the disciples to get up quickly because the time had come. Verse 48, "Now his betrayer had given them a sign, saying, 'Whomever I kiss, he is the one, seize him.'" In the darkness of the olive grove, and with so many people around him, even though they had torches, there could have been some confusion, and they wanted to make sure that they arrested the right man. And so Judas here offers the traditional Jewish greeting of a kiss, also greeting Jesus with the word Rabbi, which shows, as I think Hagner is right to point out in his commentary, that Judas had gone over to the other side. It was a way of distancing himself from Jesus and identifying himself with Jesus' enemies. But Jesus said to him, "Friend, why have you come?" He doesn't use this term friend in an ironic sense. He does not regale on him and call him all kinds of names, but simply calls him friend. And he does not get an answer from Judas. He gets arrested by the soldiers. And suddenly one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. This is Peter cutting off Malchus's ear. Of course, Malchus would have gone back and told Caiaphas, the high priest, what Jesus did. Jesus, of course, restored his ear to him. But Jesus said to him, that is Peter, "Put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Or do you not think that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels?" Now, 12 legions of angels would have been between about 36 and 50,000 angels. Now, one angel in the Old Testament killed well over 100,000 men in one night. So 30 to 50,000 angels could have wiped out the whole population of Earth in quick time. It wasn't here that God was being outmaneuvered. It looked that way. Jesus looked as though he had fallen into a trap. But Jesus was not in any kind of peril that he could not easily have extricated himself out of. But he chose not to. Why? Verse 54. How then could the scriptures be fulfilled, that it must happen thus? In that hour Jesus said to the multitudes, all the soldiers and those that came with him, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I sat daily with you teaching in the temple, and you did not seize me. But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. That includes what happens next. All the disciples forsook him and fled. The scriptures cannot be broken. The scriptures mean what they say, and they will always come through. And then Jesus here in verse 54 is brought before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was the highest court of the land among the Jews and would have been assembled quickly for this purpose. Those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard. And he went in and sat with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death. Now they couldn't have put him to death themselves, but they needed to get enough evidence against Jesus in order for the Romans to put him to death. But they found none, verse 60. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last two false witnesses came forward. Would you like to be one of these two false witnesses standing in front of God at the judgment? I don't think so. You can always find people to do the lowest of jobs, and sometimes it seems that they get away with it. But nobody gets away with sin. Nobody gets away with sinning before God. All will come to judgment, including these two false witnesses. And these two false witnesses, as well as Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, found that out. And they came forward and said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. This is the only place in Matthew where this is said. But John chapter 2 tells us that that is what he did. He did say that. And he said it when he was driving the multitudes out of the temple in John 2. By the way, that is often seen as a contradiction. Though it is perfectly possible that Jesus did it at the beginning of his ministry and at the end of his ministry. John's account was at the beginning of his ministry. It could also be that John just speaks of it thematically, although I doubt it. I really do think that it was two separate occasions. Jesus was speaking, though, about the temple of his body, not Herod's temple. And then we see Caiaphas getting all self-righteous here. In verse 62, the high priest rose and said to him, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? But Jesus kept silent. It wasn't worth arguing with these men. They had no good and just reason to do what they were doing. Their consciences were seared. They had rejected the Christ. They had rejected the scriptures that witnessed to Christ. They had rejected the miracles that they had seen. And they were set on a course to kill the Prince of Life. And the high priest answered and said to him, I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Well, what's Jesus going to say? Look at it in verse 64. It is as you said. And just to make that perfectly clear, nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. That is a direct allusion and partial quotation of Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, which was a clear messianic prediction in the Old Testament. Then the high priest tore his clothes. That is his own clothes, not Jesus' clothes. You find this kind of thing in the Old Testament, for example, in Leviticus 21:10 and 2 Kings 19:1, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look now, you have heard his blasphemy. You can see that Caiaphas here is, he seems to me anyway, to be almost mad with hatred for Jesus, as he is so quick to denounce him and pronounce sentence. What do you think? They answered and said, he is deserving of death. Then they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, prophesy to us, Christ, who is the one who struck you? You see, this is the real religious hypocrite. This is the real person, not the one who plays at piety, the one who enacts outward righteousness and who screams of blasphemy. This is the real person here, the one who mocks, spits, and bullies. This is the one that God sees and not the outward display. Then the scene moves back to Peter in verse 69. Now Peter sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him, saying, you also were with Jesus of Galilee. But he denied it before them all, saying, I do not know what you are saying. And when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, this fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth. But again he denied with an oath, I do not know the man. And a little later, those who stood by came up and said to Peter, surely you are also one of them, for your speech betrays you. It was Galilean. We should not think, by the way, that these were the only words that were exchanged between Peter and the people around him. There would have been conversations in each of these three episodes which would have included all of the individuals mentioned in the different gospel accounts of Peter's denial, as well as all of the different arguments that Peter would have used in his three denials. And so there's no contradiction here between what we read in Matthew and in Mark 14, Luke 22, and John 18. And so verse 74, then he began to curse and swear, saying, I do not know the man. And immediately a rooster crowed. Now this also shows the real Peter, doesn't it? When he's put under pressure. But this is the kind of sinner whom would be saved by Christ, in contrast to those who would not be saved by Christ, the ones mentioned in the previous verses. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus, who had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. So he went out and wept bitterly. And I'm sure he did.